Get after it, PDX. In-depth conversations with inspiring people in the creative hotbed of Portland, Oregon, and beyond. Now, let's welcome the host of Get After It PDX and the co-founder of Y East Wolfpack, Willie McBride.
Hey folks, a quick word about our sponsors. The Amesir Distilling Company, a new distillery focused on bringing people together through great flavors and a warm environment. They love the way spirits taste, but more importantly, they love that they bring people together to make memories, build bridges, and crystallize the moment. Opening in spring 2020 in Northeast Portland. Today's episode is also brought to you by Daybreak Racing, a Portland, Oregon company offering some of the finest trail running events and trail stewardship opportunities available today. Daybreak Racing has been uniting the adventurous and wild-hearted with the mountain, coast, and forest trails of the Pacific Northwest since 2016. Adventure begins at Daybreak. Visit them at daybreakracing.com.
Welcome, folks. We are back with another episode of Get After It PDX. Today, we have a very special guest, our first political candidate ever on the show, Albert Lee, who is running for Congress to represent the people of the 3rd District here in Oregon. So welcome today, Albert.
Thank you, Willie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this is cool, too. So, of course, we're on the phone, given quarantine times like we have been for the past 9 or 10 episodes we've done. But we got a little visual here. We're doing a Zoom, so I actually get to see Albert, which is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know a little bit about you, did a little bit of research. You are here, like we just said, running for Congress. Election is Tuesday. Today is Sunday, so it's coming up
very quickly.
So we want to talk about sort of the stuff right here in the present, but we also want to jump back, of course, and hear your whole story. So I'll just reiterate a couple things and then you can take it from there. So born in South Korea to an African-American soldier father and a Korean mother, came to the States at a young age, St. Louis near Ferguson, which sort of interesting that ties in politically, you know, the Black Lives Matter and the Michael Brown shooting that sparked off a lot of that stuff and plays into our political climate to this day, of course. But yeah, so tell us, what are some of your early childhood memories growing up? What was the path?
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. So first of all, thank you for having this conversation with me. I always started off by telling people that I'm a sixth generation American and an immigrant at the same time. Like you said, I was born in South Korea, where my African-American Army dad met my Korean mom during the Vietnam War. And I like to put that all in the context because it was our foreign policy, our geopolitics, the Cold War. All of these things played a part in creating me, giving me the opportunity to exist. We moved to the U.S. when I was really young, and we ended up settling down in my dad's hometown of St. Louis. St. Louis, at the time, and you know, I haven't been there in years, but I don't know how much has changed. Is a heavily segregated Midwestern city. It's got a lot of different ideas and thoughts. For one thing, it has an inferiority complex with Chicago. It believes that it's on par with Chicago. And at one time it was. It was one time one of the largest cities in the country. But since then, it has subsided dramatically. I would argue a lot of that has to do with its internal issues with race relations and how it has dealt with its population. So I grew up in North County, St. Louis. It was working class St. Louis. It was in a small enclave called Moline Acres, which was just next door to Ferguson. You know, my family, during my childhood, my dad was deployed for the most part of it. So we were effectively a single single parent household. And my mom, she worked two jobs to put my sister and me into Catholic school. Because our public schools were truly separate and unequal. So, you know, in the daytime, she worked as a cook at a nursing home. And then at night, she worked at a fast food joint, also as a cook. And, you know, so we rarely saw her. I was a latchkey kid. You know, me and my sister kind of took care of ourselves, did our homework and did our chores. And, you know, hopefully we would see her mom before we go to bed. But that was kind of our existence growing up. And then, you know, we had the privilege of going to parochial schools, but again, that came with a great sacrifice my mom made in working those two jobs.
And so those schools were better education, but also...
Well, it was a sacrifice. It was a trade-off. We got better education, but we had less time with our parents.
Yeah. But so what was, like, within those, the parochial schools, what was the, like, was it more sort of equal diversity-wise?
Oh, no.
Or no, so, was the other thing, way.
When we were growing up in North County, St. Louis, that was at a time when there was extreme white flight. Property values were depressing. The public schools were effectively segregated black schools. The Catholic schools are where those few white families that still stayed in the area, that's where they sent their kids to get them a decent education. Okay. And you know, so there, you know, we were in a minority position. I mean, in my class, there was me and two other black kids, one Filipino kid, and everyone else was white.
So multiple trade-offs. It's like good education, so
there's multiple trade-offs. And then, you know, growing up, you know, we had our friends that we grew up with in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And then we had our Catholic school friends that were not necessarily in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of caught hell from all sides. When my sister and I were little, we weren't Asian enough. We weren't black enough. Folks couldn't figure us out, and that made them uncomfortable. And as a kid, it made me uncomfortable. All I really wanted to do was fit in. And it was really hard to figure out your identity and you know, be proud of who you were. But over time, I came to realize that none of us really fit those neat little boxes. Those boxes divide us and hide us from the fact that deep down, we're really all truly the same on the inside. We all have the same hopes, the same fears, the same dreams. And for me, growing up, I came to realize that, you know, I am who I am, and I'm going to cherish who I am and be who I am.
So what kind of stuff were you interested in when you were a kid? You know, did you play sports? Were you, if somebody said to you, like, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, what sort of?
I wanted to be an astronaut. I was a bookworm, and I loved airplanes. And one of the things that was really interesting was there was a McDonnell Douglas plant nearby. And so we used to see F-18s take off from Lambert International Airfield and fly all around in the skies. And I'd spend so much time just looking up at the skies, looking up at these fighter planes and the loud noises that they were making and all the maneuvers that they were making. And I just imagined designing those planes. And incidentally, that was actually what I first started to do when I went to college was aerospace engineering and engineering physics.
So throughout your schooling... I mean, how much of that otherness was like, I assume, you know, that's always a part of your experience, and that's always going to be a part of growing up and being in a school type setting, especially, but, you know, was that like a major day-to-day struggle, or was that something that was, you know, you were able to deal
with? Well, no, I mean, I think generally speaking, from the time you get up to the time you go to bed, you are, you are definitely aware, highly aware of your otherness.
Yeah.
And for me and my sister, we didn't really find solace in any group or crowd because we seemed to be these unicorns that were completely othered from everyone else. We grew up in a St. Louis that was really focused black and white. We didn't really have much in the way of diversity of any sort. And that was the thing. If we fell in that undefined character category that does not compute. You're not black. You're not white. We don't know where to put you. And so we, like I said, we caught hell from all sides. But it wasn't really until college, I would say, that I started to really, truly embrace myself. And it was during the time of growing up and during college that, you know, I came to realize that, you know, I don't fit in anywhere, but I fit in everywhere. So I remember spending time in college, being able to get inside most of the fraternal organizations and whatnot, and be able to hang out with everyone because I really wasn't a part of anything. But it gave me an opportunity to really be observant and kind of listen and pick up cues and get that kind of situational awareness so that I developed a really strong empathy and understanding of other folks' perspectives. And I think that that's something that's really vitally important for somebody that wants to represent an entire district to Congress is you're not going to agree with everybody. You're not going to even come from the same perspectives. But if you have the imagination and have the ability to empathize, have the ability to see it from someone else's vantage point, you can come at it and see their, get an understanding of why folks believe, act, or behave in a certain way. It doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily agree, but it will help you as you shape and develop your representation of the district.
So one thing I read about your experience growing up was that at one point you and your mother and sister spent time in some shelters because there was some stuff going on at home, domestic violence, I believe, and you were at some points homeless or yes. staying in shelters. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, no. So my dad was deployed for most of my childhood. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, he was riffed out of the Army. That's reduction in forces. He was getting pretty close to retirement, and the Defense Department decided they wanted to cut the budget. Mm-hmm. And instead of cutting toys or military equipment and hardware, they decided to go ahead and try to attack as many folks that were closest to pension to force out. Which was really, truly, sorely a horrible way of doing things, especially for folks that signed up and volunteered to serve their country in the middle of a hot war. But my sophomore year of high school, he returned home with to us. And, you know, my father did not have a great childhood. He navigated and lived through an immense amount of individual, systemic, structural, and internalized racism. And when he came back home with him, he brought his demons. Now, this was before the Violence Against Women Act. Mm-hmm. There was really not a whole lot that you couldn't get away with your family. Eventually, we would have to run away. 16 years old, I drove my mom and my sister in our little Chevy Cavalier East to an unknown safety, to an unknown destination. We headed, ended up outside of Pittsburgh at a battered women's shelter. But like most victims of domestic violence, we ended up returning home really? About a month later.
To him?
To him.
Yeah.
And about another month later, we were back out. Initially, we were on a friend of a friend's houseboat, you know, seeking refuge, trying to stay away, hiding. Then to another shelter. This shelter wouldn't take me because I was too old. So then me and my sister were split up, and my mom and my sister ended up at the battered women's shelter. I ended up at a youth shelter. We bounced around a couple other places. We ended up leaving the city again, went from shelter to shelter until a kind family, complete strangers, took us in and helped us get back on our feet, helped us to get back into school, helped us to, my mom and me, to find jobs. And eventually helped us to secure our own two-bedroom basement apartment.
So what years, how old were you during that time?
16, 17 years old.
Okay. Jeez.
And I just learned that it was the Ponebiancos, Helen and George Ponebianco. Unfortunately, I just found out that George recently passed away about a month ago, at the age of 87. But he was, he and Helen were really, really beautiful, loving people who not only helped me and my family, but have helped so many other families on a regular basis. They are full of love, full of grace. And quite frankly, without them, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now.
Wow. So how did you guys get connected to them?
So we were at the Rosebrooks city. The executive director saw us, met us, and for whatever reason decided that she wanted to connect us to her close friends, and they were there. They were her close friends. I think that there were some mutual connections since we were Catholic and we went to Catholic schools. But there was also some implicit bias because, you know, at many of the different shelters that we stayed at, we heard that that term that we didn't belong there. And what they really meant was, you know, you're not the usual, you know, white trash or poor black folks that we normally see coming through here. You guys are different. And, you know, I feel bad about that. I feel like, you know, that on the one hand provided us a benefit and a special treatment that we didn't really deserve, that we didn't, you know, we were just like every other family there seeking refuge. But through their implicit bias, they found that we were better than, or that we deserved better. Yeah. So I'm still wrestling with that.
Yeah. It's a lot to wrestle with. So not to dig too deep into this one, but, so was there like a substance type issue, or, you know, was it alcohol or fueled by anything else? Or was it just,
there's a lot of mental pent up rage, for my father. For me, it's not hard to understand. If you are constantly berated and you're constantly abused and you're constantly told that you're less than, you're going to have a vent somewhere.
Yep.
And unfortunately for us, we were the vent. And I, you know, we look to this very day, the treatment of black folks, black and indigenous folks here in our country, effectively treated as second class citizens, considered criminal, and guilty before, predetermined, summarily executed, extrajudicial killings on a regular basis by police and by neighbors, that don't seem to face any kind of real justice. So in a sense, if you're walking through your entire life being told that you're less than, that you're subhuman, that you are worthless, I can see how that can develop a rage within a person. I'm not trying to make excuses for my father, but as I navigate my life and understanding I am more compassionate about his perspective and what he had to go through.
Yeah.
Not to excuse his behavior, but to understand it.
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes it's surprising that more people don't seem outright rage-filled with all the just stunning injustice that goes on all the time. So when you got back on your feet, so it was really that family or that couple that helped, you said, made the difference.
No, I mean, quite frankly, we got help from a lot of people from a lot of places, from strangers to friends.
Yeah.
From that first trip out to Pittsburgh, you know, we were directed by a parish priest in a local parish to the shelter in northwest Pittsburgh. From there, we had a kind volunteer who took us in at her house there. When we returned back to St. Louis, we had friends and family, or friends and neighbors who helped us secure us some shelter, give us some funds. Mm-hmm. And then when we were in Kansas City, you know, it wasn't just the Pano Biancos, but we were countless other folks that you know, gave a helping hand and, you know, tried to provide us some comfort and solace. I thank them all. And, you know, again, without the help of friends and strangers, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad they helped out. I'm glad you're here. So what was next? What, I mean, obviously that's a monumental turn of events.
Well, I mean, it's an incredible trauma to experience. It's, we spent a lot of time looking over shoulders, wondering if we were going to be found.
Looking for you?
Well, we didn't know if he was or not,
yeah.
But it was a fear.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the next thing was, I was wrapping up high school. I was in my fifth high school in three states. Really not looking or prepared for a future. Didn't do very well my final year of high school. for obvious reasons. And my mom's best friend stepped up and she said, you know, you're going to go to school for at least 1 year. And she gave me her savings, $10,000. Wow. And that was the reason why I got to become a first generation college graduate. But for her generosity, I wouldn't have started that first year of school, which eventually led to my completion and receiving a degree. After college, I joined the Army. After the Army, I worked in international trade before coming out here to Oregon. I was recruited by General Electric, started working as a project manager down in Salem, worked in Portland. I had a great time. We had the recession coming 2007-ish. The clouds were starting to darken. I was one of the last project managers hired. So last in, first out was my understanding of how things worked. So yeah. I started to try to get certifications for project management. And on a lark, decided to take an LSAT test for law school. And I did well, which encouraged me to go ahead and apply for law school. And I applied and I went to law school. From there, graduated, worked in legal research, worked for the American Bar Association, met my wife. We had our kid, and then we returned back here to Oregon, a place that I love, to raise her and to start a business. I would eventually move on to become one of the deans of Portland Community College. And fast forward to today, I've stepped down from that position to make this challenge. So we've been running for over a year now for this seat, and now we're 2 days away mm-hmm. from the primary decision from the people of the 3rd District. So when I look at it, I look at my series of experiences from being, you know, the personal experience with domestic violence and homelessness to being a first-generation college grad, first-generation law school grad, service in the military, working in international trade, working in law, project management, owning my own business, and being a dean at the local community college. I think that the combination of my professional and my lived experience really bode well for someone who wants to truly represent all of the people of the 3rd District as opposed to just those at the very top. So I think that the combination of those experiences really provide me this perspective and the empathy necessary in order to be a good representative for our district.
Sounds like it to me as well. What business did you have?
We had a digital design business, One Plum Design. It is still in existence, though it technically is now my wife's business solely. And we aren't really taking a whole lot more clients on with that business. Some of the things that we have done in the past, we did the website and branding for Joanne Hardesty's campaign. We did Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. A lot of small businesses in the area, including Delicious Donuts and Grab a Gyro, small mom and pops. I mean, we really like to focus on small mom and pops and nonprofits for the most part to help those folks out.
That's so cool. That's a lot of varied skills you got.
Thank you.
Dang. Cool. In running for 3rd District, you said that there are three major issues you see that are sort of challenging to us living optimally in the 3rd District, and that is homelessness, inability to thrive, and climate emergency. So obviously homelessness is, or that part of the three issues is pretty clear to know what that is and see what that is, and you know, we're all aware of that issue here. But inability to thrive is I'm interested to hear have you explained that a little more? And then, again, obviously, climate emergency is sort of all around us, but your take on that and, like, what is the most sort of immediate steps to be done to confront that challenge? So tell us, inability to thrive in climate emergency in the 3rd District, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, so when I talk about the inability to thrive, I'll move back to 2005 when I first moved here. When I first moved to Portland, I moved here as an economic migrant. I was living and working in Washington, D.C. I had a decent job working in international trade, yet I had three, sometimes four roommates that would share a row house because we simply could not afford to have a place of our own. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to a place where I could be a professional and be able to live as an adult without roommates. And I found that place here in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Now, when we return back here in 2015, we see that we see a complete lack of affordable housing. In 2005, I had the ability to purchase a small condo. Today, we are renters again. Now, when I look at that, I also look on the other hand with the lack of living wages. Now, we are in progressive Portland, where we have a minimum wage of $2.25 an hour, which is pretty amazing given that the minimum wage on the federal level is $7.25 an hour. Sad thing about it is neither one of those wages are a living wage. In other words, you cannot work one 40-hour job at that minimum wage, mm-hmm. either on the federal level or on our local minimum wage level, mm-hmm. and be able to take care of you and your family. When we look at our minimum wage, simply from the 1970s, if we peg that to inflation, it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $33 an hour. When I talk to economists here in the Portland area, they say you need an average of $28 an hour to be able to live on one 40-hour job. So again, we have a suppression of our minimum wage. The minimum wage in turn anchors all other wages. So for many, many folks, the combination of the lack of a living wage and the lack of affordable housing really places way too many of us into the struggling class. It just takes one car accident, one medical bill, one eviction, and people can quickly find themselves in a really hard place, couch surfing or worse. So I think that there are a lot of different things that play into our lack of an ability to thrive. But one thing we need to do is we need to get a living wage. In addition to that, we need to separate our healthcare from our employment, because this whole employment-based healthcare system is failing. You see this right now with the COVID crisis. Yeah. When 30 million people, have lost their job, that means 30 million families don't have health insurance. We need to do something that we can separate that so that people have the ability to be more free to move about, be more free to take on new and more exciting work, be able to have a better quality of life. So I think that we do need to do that, but also we need to focus on the affordable housing section of the whole thing. Right now, we have real estate developers that really develop for investment. You know, we've got high rises that are consisting of studios and one bedrooms. Those aren't designed for families. Those aren't designed for the folks that are living here. Those are designed so that somebody can purchase that and then in turn rent it out so that they can make money both on the rent and then on the appreciation of the real estate. If we really want to get to an affordable housing situation, we need to do two things. Number one, we need to start focusing on building for the people that live here, building for families. And secondly, we should be looking at truly mixed income social housing to help to provide affordable housing that would be beneficial to everyone that lives here, as opposed to investment properties. Now, when you, the second part of your question was the climate emergency. And when you're talking about the climate emergency, this is a global issue, but it's also a local issue. When I first moved here in 2005, I remember the vast majority of folks did not have air conditioning. And I remember the summers where it was 75 degrees were the highs, and maybe a couple of times we'd break the 80s and 90s. Today, we've got 90s starting in April and May. And we've got weeks where it's triple digits. For a lot of people that want to say that this is the new normal, I say nay, nay. I say this is not, and it should not be allowed to be considered the new normal. You know, not last summer, but the two summers before that, I was putting a face mask on my daughter because of the wildfires. Yeah. Now, there's an argument to say that those aren't really wildfires, those are all man-made fires. But again, what we're doing, the abuses that we have been doing for over 150 years with the Industrial Revolution to our only home, our only planet, these things have to stop. And so long as we have money in politics, so long as we have corporations that buy off and pay off both sides of our aisle, we continue to see incremental steps. We continue to see delay, foot dragging, so that they can continue to extract as much profit out of the current fossil fuel industries until we finally shut them all the way down. What we really need to do is we need to shut them down right now. We need to do everything we can to end the subsidies on fossil fuels. We need to stop digging new fossil fuel infrastructure, and we need to start focusing on replacing those with a renewable system, replacing those with energy capture systems, and developing the new technologies and in our future that is going to protect the people and planet over profits. So, you know, this has been an emergency for over a generation. It's been an emergency my entire life. I'm 45 years old. We have fossil fuel companies I've known for 50 years what they've been doing. And, you know, again, the folks that we have in leadership right now just simply aren't cutting it. They're not doing enough fast enough. And, you know, for me, I've got a 6-year-old daughter. She needs a planet to live on, a stable country and government to live in, and a life worth living. So, I think we need bold action now, not just inspirational words.
I fully agree with that. It's obviously, I love it to see this story and all the pieces that led up, especially somebody going into something like politics. I feel like, that's sort of my next question is like, where was that turning point of like, or that spark of like thinking that you actually would consider doing something like this, consider running for a political position? Like where along the way did that thread start of actually thinking about that?
Well, I've always been interested in politics, and I've always had a pretty wide worldview. I mean, having been born in Korea, growing up in St. Louis, I was very conscious of a greater world than just the place that I grew up. But really, what was the impetus, what was the spark for me to take on this challenge is my daughter, her future. You know, when my wife and I were initially thinking about having kids, we were really considering not having kids and saying, you know, what does our future hold? Now that she is here, I've got to do everything I can to fight for her future. You know, it was devastating to have to put a face mask on her in the summers as a baby, 3 and 4 years old. And seeing just the lack of imagination, the lack of authority, the lack of direction from our government to do anything about this slow moving train wreck that we have that's now starting to pick up tremendous speed.
And, you're talking about the wildfires.
I'm talking about wildfires. Exactly. I'm talking about the devastation of 500 year floods that are happening every year. Yeah. I'm talking about a continent that was on fire 2 months ago that now we're not even talking about because we have this short attention span and we're now focused on COVID. But it just doesn't seem like enough of us have the presence of mind or the consciousness to say, we are in a world of hurt. We have constantly been given more and more signs that we need to stop. You know, when we have a trillion gallons of water coming down on Houston 2 summers ago, when we have 500-year floods that happen every year, when we have an entire continent on fire, these are amazing. Huge signs. You know, it's just like, you know, for those that have faith or are believers, you know, God, show me a sign. I mean, there's a huge sign every single day. Now we need to do the bold action required to fix the things that we've caused.
Well, I think the real message also of the whole pandemic going on is to sort of reveal just the absolute failure of so many. Well, specifically our government, but so many political bodies of just complete failure and complete lack of planning and execution. And there's corruption that led to some of those things. And it's just such a train wreck that I feel like we have environmental examples and things showing us that we need to change. And then there's hopefully this is making people realize that we have other things we need to change, like who's running things.
Well, I think that's kind of the biggest issue, is who's running things. I mean, we like to say that we live in a democracy, but we have so much more in common with a lot of the other countries around the world. When you just look at who's in leadership, who's in power, who are the people that run the governments around the world, the majority of them come from the 1%. The majority of them come from the wealthy, the upper class, if you will. Here in our country, 52% of the members of Congress are multimillionaires. You know, here in our state, we've got 5 representatives to the House of Representatives. 100% of them are multimillionaires. 100% of them are property owners. 100% of them are over the age of 62. And 100% of them are white. 4 out of 5 of them are men. This simply isn't representative of the people of the state of Oregon, where less than 1.4% of us are millionaires, where a good 44% of us are not homeowners, not property owners, myself included, where a good 75% of us are below the age of 62, where a good 15 to 18% of us are not white, and where half of us are women. We need to have a more representative contingency, a more representative delegation to Congress, to the people's house, to the lower house. If we have everybody cut from the same cloth, if they all come from the same upper crust, there's going to be huge blind spots. There's going to be a focus on their needs and issues and not the needs of the rest of us. We need to have more citizen representatives, and we need to replace those career politicians, career multimillionaire politicians, with citizen representatives who know our struggle, who won't take that corporate contribution, and who will truly represent and fight for the people.
Do you feel like, and I'm sure you do, but do you feel like there's the potential for Portland to continue growing and continue? I mean, like right now, of course, in the past few years, the expansion and the growth and the development within Portland is staggering. It's quite staggering, right? You go to a neighborhood you haven't been to for a while and you're like, oh my God,
there's don't recognize it at all.
Literally, yeah. You don't recognize it at all. There's new buildings everywhere, old buildings torn down. So, I mean, do you think like that sort of rapid development, rapid quote unquote progress is even able to be sustainable or not just sustainable, but can it work for the people?
Yes, it can. You know, the only constant that we have is change, right? So we have to adapt and be adaptable to it. I think the biggest thing that we need to focus on more than anything else when it comes to this change is to stop our lack of imagination, stop focusing on individual 20th century solutions, and get to more collective 21st century solutions. So, you know, one of the examples that I always like to put up there is, you know, we've got Tesla out there now, and we've got a whole bunch of other companies that are vying to become the next great maker of electric vehicles. Rivian, I like their trucks, for instance. But what we're doing, if we're just going that far, is we're maintaining the 20th century individual solution. We're looking at individual battery electric vehicles to replace individual internal combustion engine vehicles, ICE vehicles. So we're getting rid of fossil fuels and we're using electric-based vehicles, but we're still going to have the same congestion. We're going to still have the same waste and the same individual uses of vehicles, and we're going to dig out rare earths out of the earth in order to fuel those batteries. When we should be doing more collective thinking, saying, hey, how do we make our public roads truly public? How do we, focus on having a more fair, equitable, free transit system so that people aren't all having their individual cars to do their individual errands and make things more efficient? How do we, rezone our cities so that we don't have these large lots with all this grass and single family houses, 5,000, 10,000 square foot single family houses, and, make it so that we can have fourplexes, make it so that we can have more high density living that's going to be more efficient use of energy, more efficient ways of doing things. We are going to continue to grow. And, you know, we're at what, 8 billion people on the planet right now. If we're going to be able to harness and judiciously share those resources of the planet, we're going to have to be a lot more efficient. We're going to have to start being more collective and stop being so selfish and so individualistic when we think about the ways that we do things.
So basically the march of progress is not going to stop, but we just got to do it smarter if we're going to, it's going to work for us. Yeah. So you identify as a Democrat and a Democratic Socialist?
I am a Democratic Socialist running in the Democratic primary for the Democratic primaries position.
Okay. And the word socialist, of course, is sort of, you know, it's like a bad word to a lot of people.
Is it?
I think a lot of people who don't really understand what it is, you know, it's like, oh, that's it's like a cousin to communism. You know, it's terrible.
Uh-huh.
You're a socialist, must mean bad. But talk to us about that. Because again, I have heard, you know, I think, you know, it's like a lot of people are like, well, Bernie Sanders, he's a socialist. Don't vote for him. So how do you take the Democratic Socialist angle?
Yeah, no, thank you. We really can break down, you know, the general idea of that term socialist and split it at my age point, 45. So 45 and above, it has a negative connotation. 45 and below, it's got a generally positive connotation. And I think that is a cultural generational shift, a generational split. Growing up, I remember the Cold Wars and I remember all of the things that revolved around that. We had the sirens and the nuclear Holocaust drills, etc. And there was a conflation of the term communism with socialism. All of those things were bad. All of those things were red. So generally speaking, folks older than me generally have that idea. Folks that are younger than me, when they think of socialism, they think of Sweden. You know, they think of Scandinavia. They think of all of the benefits. They think of, you know, how raw a deal they have right now, where by the time they're a fully fledged adult, they have mountains of debt, a mortgage-sized loan when it comes to school loans, mm-hmm. not able to afford a family, not able to afford basic things that they need in order to become independent individuals. So socialism looks something very good. Mm-hmm. For me, I believe that we reached peak capitalism. I think that we have gotten to a point where we have overproduction, overconsumption, and built-in obsolescence that has caused our climate emergency, that has caused our endless wars, that has caused this immense wealth gap and disparity where far too many of us are struggling. And there's this insane, obscene, immoral concentration of wealth into the hands of the very few. It is unsustainable. So for me, as a Democratic Socialist, I look at it and I say, you know, arguably we have political democracy. We need to mate that political democracy with economic democracy. And what I mean by that is simply that workers have more of a say in how things are done. For instance, if say McDonald's, for instance, if McDonald's actually had frontline workers in their board of directors, I guarantee that the CEO wouldn't be making as much as the average worker makes in a year, in a day. I guarantee that we wouldn't have such an obscene difference in salaries. When we, in the 1950s, we had basically a 7 or 8 to 1 difference between how much the person on the top made versus the person on the bottom. Today, it's somewhere near 800 to 1. And that is just completely unsustainable. It twists everything from the way that our politics are handled to the way that things are divvied out. Because when we talk about politics, it's a matter of who gets what and how. With 40 years of the Supreme Court decisions from Buckley v. Vallejo to Citizens United, we've had two things that have happened. Number one, money is now speech. So the more money you have, the more speech you have. And number two, corporations are people. So, you know, those two things together drown out the voices of the many. They drown out the voices of those at the bottom. They drown out the voices of workers. We need to change that. We need to have a government that works for all of us and not just those at the very top. And so I am a vast, strong proponent of socialist ideas. I think that when you look at some of the biggest organizations that we have, the military, for one, I experienced socialism in the military. We had socialized medicine when I was growing up. The way that the system is set up is ideal. And I think that I'm looking for a solution to the ills that we have received from deep capitalism.
And it does feel that the actual landscape of Portland is changing sort of in that sort of business and corporate sense of there are more big corporations coming to town now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like now you have Google coming in and you have, and that also has explained some of the massive growth over the past years is those entities coming in and providing this influx of capital and people moving here for those jobs. So, so I thought it interesting tying into Ferguson, St. Louis area where you initially grew up. And so that case, Michael Brown, that sparked Black Lives Matter, because I saw on your list of civic engagements was you were involved with the Independent Police Review and some of those things related to the police department and handling of situations here. So could you tell us a little bit about that? Because especially recently, the Ahmaud Arbery case, obviously that wasn't directly involving police, although...
A former police officer. Yeah,
former, and it seems as more information comes out that there was a calculated effort between law enforcement and ex-law enforcement to...
And that's exactly the thing that citizen review committees and citizen oversight of police is all about. We provide far too much power into the hands of our police forces. And when you look at the systems and structures that are in place for our police departments, they are an extension of things that have gone on from the days of slavery. You know, the overseers from the slave times have become the sheriffs. And, you know, when we look at the Deep South and the history there, the extrajudicial killings, the lynchings, the rule, not of law, but the rule of terror came straight from those organizations. We need to have citizen oversight of our police departments. I think that we need to reduce the powers of police unions. I think that there is far too much power for them and far too little power for the citizenship. Here in our state, in our city, I was appointed to the city by the city council to the Citizens Review Committee. It was an 11-member panel that looks at police action against civilians. The problem with that group is the standard of review. The standard of review is incredibly weak. And ultimately what it does is it allows citizens to basically say, hey, we had an opportunity to review this, but we can't really do anything about it. So it is effectively window dressing for the police. I think that we need to build out stronger, more independent citizen review of police departments. I think we need to weaken the power and the control of police unions. And I think that we need to have more transparency when it comes to the way that contracts are settled and drafted and then entered into by the city. The last police contract here in the city of Portland was completed behind closed doors by a lame duck mayor that was on his way out, Charlie Hales. That provided way, way too much power and authority to the police with way too little oversight. So again, I think that we need to do everything we can to control those organizations. And quite frankly, when it comes to the police departments, if they're truly there to protect and serve, I think that there are two things that we need to do. We need to ensure that our police actually live within the areas that they are patrolling. So the majority of the police department for Portland police don't live in Portland. They live out in Estacada, Malala, Ridgefield, Camas, Vancouver. And so there's this whole us versus them mentality, you know, us on the thin blue line versus them, the people that we have to control. That's got to stop. That's got to change. So I think that we should hire police who are within the community. Number two, I think that we need to take a look at having a system that of independent review when it comes to police actions. We shouldn't allow things to go through grand jury, through closed doors. We need this stuff out in the open. We need to police the police.
Yeah, really, really important stuff. Sadly, cases showing that we need oversight all the time, every single day happening. So we're winding down. I'm going to ask you the question that we ask all the guests as we, you know, hear their story and how they got to be where they're at today. Because, of course, part of the reason for the Get After It PDX is trying to provide inspiring content for people who might be stuck in their struggle, in their path, trying to figure out how to follow their passions, which way to turn. So you clearly are doing really amazing stuff now. You're amazing work. You're about to go into this election in 2 days. So what is your advice? I mean, you've overcome amazing hardship. You've dealt with all sorts of crazy life experiences and ups and downs. What bits of wisdom and advice would you give to somebody in the struggle?
I think you follow your passions. I mean, for me, if you look at my resume, it's all over the place. You know, I start off going into aerospace engineering physics, found that I really detested math. So I switched over to political science, history, and international relations. Wanted to go into the State Department and was too poor to go to the final assessment in D.C. I ended up in the military.
You were too what?
Too poor to get out there to do the final assessment. You know, I ended up in the military, learned some stuff there, got some discipline. Then fell into international trade, then fell into project management. And then by necessity for an economy of starting to turn south, started seeking other opportunities. I think that one of the things that you got to be is to be resilient and to be responsive to what opportunities lie ahead of you. I think that generally speaking, none of us, you can have a plan for your future. You can have a path that you want to go down. But the future is dependent not only on your path and your persistence, but also on how you are able to cope with the realities that come your way. So I think that you roll with the punches, you take a look and you try to acquire as much experience and pick up the grain of pick up the grains that you get even from the things that are really difficult and just work with it. And I think you find your way.
So in this process leading up to the coming election in 2 days, I mean, I'm sure like all of life, there's been ups and downs. During the down times or times maybe you doubt yourself or you doubt the process or something. How do you get through? What do you tell yourself? How do you keep fighting the good fight?
Fighting a good fight. Number one, we're all mortals, right? We only have a limited time on this planet. Make the most of it. I don't think there's a whole lot of time to mourn things. I think that, yeah, you should definitely take time to mourn, but then you get up, pick yourself up and move on. Use the precious little time that you have to do the things that you feel ought to be done, the things that you feel are best for you and yours. I think that generally speaking, none of us are guaranteed, anything. And you got to have perspective because as bad or as good as your position is, there's always someone who has suffered more, somebody who has done more. And I don't think that you need to compare yourself to others. I think that you should do what you feel is guiding you from within.
Great. Well, glad you are guided by what is, what keeps you passionate and doing this work. That's awesome to see all these people that have affected your life and now this desire to give back to all these different people, all these different sorts of people and groups of people and country folk and city folk and different colors. And good luck on Tuesday.
Appreciate
you coming and sharing your story with us. And yeah, I really appreciate your perspectives and your desire to do good and help people and make us better able to thrive here in Portland in our third district. Thanks so much, Albert. It's been great to talk to you today.
I appreciate it. I hope you have a great day, and we're looking forward to Tuesday. Come with me.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be rooting for you. All right. Have Thank a great you. Rest of your day.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
This wraps up another edition of
the Get After It PDX podcast.
For more information about today's guest, including social media links, please check out the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn to get out there
and get after it.